Hi, this is John Hockenberry, and speaking to someone who clearly loves to listen at the time of their choosing, you should give the WNYC app a try, you know? Not only can you listen to this program, but it'll also automatically search for the kinds of stories and subjects you like. It's really cool, and it's free. There are other apps and radio stations available, but thanks for listening. Here's today's program. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, and you know by now, I'm sure, that Black Friday deals have been extended to Black Monday. It's just black all week, all month, all year. B24/7, that's America in this century. We kind of coined that for you. You can take it, rip it off. Let's hope your holidays stimulated your mind and heart as well as the economy this time around. Hysteria over Star Wars, power lines, and the donated blood of gay men. Can you answer which hysteria is fully warranted? If you answered Star Wars, you were correct. But we begin with the very real hysteria that grips high school students around this time of year applying for colleges. December 1st, a Black Monday, if you have to submit a college application. That's the soft deadline for applying to most American colleges and universities if you're planning to start your freshman year in the fall of 2015. It's been a long couple of months for some of you out there. Affirmative action programs and admissions policies remain controversial and are just one way for schools to deal with the question of diversity on campus. Many schools aggressively argue that their campus life is designed to minimize the shock for students who are talented but who might need extra help and a familiar social environment in the early going. How challenging do you think college is going to be for you? How worried about it are you? We'd love to hear from you. When African American and other minority students drop out of college after being aggressively recruited, that's a failure both for student and institutions. So what are the support models for all kinds of students facing challenges that work? Joining us is Jacques Steinberg, Senior Vice President at Say Yes to Education and author of The Gatekeepers, Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. Also with us is Debbie Beal, President and Founder of the Posse Foundation. Welcome to you both.
Hello. Hello. Thanks for having me.
Debbie Beal, based on your experience with the Posse Foundation, do parents and even students get the potential for culture shock in the first year of college at whatever level they may be at?
I think no kid really sees what's ahead of her before she gets to campus, before he gets to campus. It's a culture shock for any student. And you're right, it's a culture shock for parents too, because life changes dramatically.
And the narrative that we've grown to accept is that the story ends once you're accepted, and that's, for you, not the case at all.
Right. Well, for Posse, which started because of a kid who had dropped out of college, the culture shock was so extreme. You know, he said, I never would have dropped out if I had my posse with me. That kind of allowed us to see that if you could send a student with a group to college, he would have a built-in support system. And so that's what we do. We make sure that students have wraparound supports, not just on their way to college as they transition from high school to college, but all the way through college.
So Posse candidates typically satisfy what sort of criteria? What's an ideal Posse candidate, and how does that work on campus?
What's interesting about Posse is we're a college success and leadership program. So we're looking for young people who are very dynamic, very motivated, very ambitious. And so our kids are coming from big urban public school systems. They're generally very, very diverse groups of students. We end up with probably 80% who are Black and Latino. And, you know, most of the students are not coming from wealthy backgrounds. But that's because we're recruiting from these very diverse urban public school systems.
And you want them to succeed in what kinds of schools who've become your partners?
We have 51 partner colleges and universities, all very selective institutions, schools like Bryn Mawr and Brandeis and University of Wisconsin-Madison and Cornell, really wonderful schools.
Jacques, does the fact that you would need this kind of support group for this demographic of students suggest that there's a flaw in the education system, that in fact education is serving a narrower and narrower demographic?
Well, it's certainly the work that Posse is doing is extraordinary in terms of sort of identifying that need and correcting for it. The organization I work for, Say Yes to Education, is coming at it in a way that's both similar and different. We're trying to offer the same wraparound supports that Debbie is suggesting, but beginning as early as kindergarten in entire cities, the entire city of Syracuse, the entire city of Buffalo, with the goal that every student who graduates from the public high school will have access to a full tuition scholarship, either to an in-state public or to one of our 70 private college partners, but also that they will have had the supports to be ready to take advantage of that opportunity.
Is it your experience that parents who would decide to emulate your program and basically start in the elementary years and go high admissions office at Georgetown or Florida State, I think my kid is talented. Anything I should be doing now? I'd love to let you know about their progress, something like that. Is that parent considered a nut, or is that parent trying something that works for you in these community-wide models?
Well, it's important to know that in our case, I mean, we're starting working with kids in the elementary grades, but we're certainly not, you know, teaching them how to spell Harvard and Yale.
Right.
But I do think that it's important to know in the middle school years if you really, as an applicant or as a family, have identified one of these highly selective institutions as a goal. Knowing in seventh and eighth grade that you need to take some really tough courses in high school is really important information, and making sure that you're ready for those courses. Finding out that information in the 11th grade is a little late.
Is there a way, Debbie, to take the pressure off of getting into these absolute top-level schools? It seems that finances are very challenging right now, and the proliferation of college professors in the post-war period in the United States means there are a lot of great schools out there, even though they don't get this top-level reputation. How do you encourage kids, even talented kids, who think they're, you know, Harvard material, to understand that they're going to find a great education at a lot of places that they wouldn't normally think of?
Oh, I could not agree with you more. There are so many outstanding institutions of higher education. We've got 1,400 about four-year institutions in the United States. And when you're talking about the schools everybody thinks are the best, that's a very, very small percentage of those schools. There are so many more that are wonderful institutions. And I know now there's a trend, Jacques, right, to apply to 20 or 30 institutions. Kids don't need to do that. You know, pick seven, pick eight, and apply to those schools and really be thoughtful about schools that match your interests. And remember, there's a lot of financial aid out there for kids. I think young people, especially young people who come from low-income backgrounds, don't realize how much aid there is.
You mentioned financial aid, but last question before we go. Should all college students, prospective college students, read a book called Living with Debt in Your 20s at this day and age, Jacques?
They certainly should be familiar with that concept, and they all should fill out, all their families should fill out the FAFSA and the CSS student profile to make sure that if they're eligible for aid that they do get it.
And for any student who's thinking maybe I shouldn't apply to college, they should think twice. College is critically important for our lives, for our careers, if they're going to compete in a very competitive workforce. We need to go to college.
Debbie Beal is president and founder of the Posse Foundation. Jacques Steinberg is senior vice president at Say Yes to Education and author of The Gatekeepers: Inside the Admissions Process of a Premier College. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You're listening to The Takeaway from WNYC and PRI Public Radio International in collaboration with The New York Times and WGBH Boston Public Radio.
The frenzy and uncertainty surrounding disease epidemics has social consequences, and some treatment and prevention techniques can inflame social consequences that can linger. Ebola, for instance, has already fractured ancient village practices of greetings, family affection, and burial rites. It has stigmatized whole nations and people out of misguided fear. During the AIDS-HIV crisis, gay men were banned from giving blood, fearing a contamination of the blood supply. Now a Health and Human Services Committee has voted to revise the 31-year ban and institute a one-year deferral period to mean that men who have had sex with other men within the past 12 months would not be permitted to give blood. The recommendation goes before a Food and Drug Administration advisory panel tomorrow for an eventual vote. Jason Cianciato is Director of Public Policy at the Gay Men's Health Crisis and HIV/AIDS Service Organization based here in New York. Welcome, Jason.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
So what do you think was the original motive of this ban, and can you set it in the context of there was a frenzy surrounding AIDS in the 1980s, that's for sure, in terms of misguided fears all over the place.
In the early 1980s, when the ban was put in place, very little was known about HIV. And there were a large number of people who require blood products to stay alive, including people living with hemophilia, who contracted HIV through tainted blood, including Ryan White, the young man for whom the Ryan White Care Act is named after. And so there was good reason for there to be caution and concern. But as you pointed out, that's been over 30 years ago. We know a tremendous more about HIV, and we have technology that can detect HIV in blood within 10 days of transmission. So this policy is outdated and needs to be changed.
So I'm guessing you're in your 30s.
I will be 40 in 6 months.
All right. I guessed right. Describe the time that you first tried to give blood, and it was well after we knew all of the things that you've just described.
Correct. I was 17, and like many high schools and colleges around the nation, we were having a blood drive. And I wanted to be a part of school spirit. I wanted to be a part of doing something good. So I went into my high school gymnasium and filled out some paperwork and sat down in front of a woman. I don't know if she was a nurse or a technician. And we were, you know, going through a number of questions. And then suddenly the question came, have you had sex with another man even just once since 1977? And the question just floored me. I didn't know why she was asking me that. I was in the closet, very afraid of discrimination and harassment and rejection in school and rejection from my family. And, you know, did she know something about me that I didn't know? Why was she asking me this question? What did she mean? Did you ever have sex with another man?
Did you interact with her?
You know, I think that I just was quiet and answered the question and moved on.
But otherwise, you would have had to come out right then and there, probably the biggest decision of your life at that point in your life.
Absolutely.
Just because of a questionnaire.
And, you know, it also raises one of the challenges of the question that makes this process so far so unscientific. You know, at that time in my life, I had yet to participate in any kind of high-risk sexual behavior that would have exposed me to HIV. And it points out the problem inherent to this day. Screening for donors should be based on the risk assessment of their behavior, not on their sexual orientation or gender identity. A focus solely on sexual orientation not only is unscientific in that it allows people to give blood or defers people for shorter periods of time who participate in just as high-risk sexual behavior, but it also reinforces the stigma and discrimination that drives the HIV epidemic in the U.S. You know, when I was that 17-year-old kid, what that experience did was reinforce for me that being gay as an identity was inherently diseased. And the fallacies that I had been taught that being gay was automatically equated with catching HIV and dying were only reinforced. And it's prevailing to this day. And this is a federal policy that reinforces it. And that's why it needs to change.
When should it have changed, do you think? How should these things be handled?
What we're advocating for is a change from a identity-based deferral to a risk-based screening tool. And that's already been happening for over a decade in countries like Italy, which has not seen an increase in transfusion-related HIV transmission since it changed that policy. You know, this 12-month policy that they're going to be debating tomorrow, this is a policy that has been going on in Australia since 2000 for 14 years. And the U.S. is lagging 14 years behind the 12-month deferral policy and just about as long behind a risk-based deferral policy. And for the FDA, what it really comes down to is money. In 2010, when the studies for which we're going to hear data at tomorrow's meeting were put in motion, there was a decision not to fund the study that could create a new donor history questionnaire that would focus on assessing risk of behavior rather than identity. So right then and there, we knew that the chance of switching to this policy of risk-based deferral was not going to happen.
Although it's not about money. I mean, it's a paltry sum to fund a study compared to, you know, buying a tank or a fighter jet or something like that. The reasons for not funding that are all political.
Absolutely. But in the age of austerity where we see non-defense discretionary funding cut further and further, it actually is an issue of medical health research. And so, you know, one of the questions that I'm going to be asking the committee tomorrow when I give my testimony is, what is the price of discrimination? What is the price of HIV stigma for the United States and its blood donation policy? Because the decision to not spend the money to do the research necessary to support this change in policy is a decision to continue the message that automatically equates HIV with being gay and bisexual. You know, the CDC recently put out data that showed between 2002 and 2011 a 138% increase in HIV transmission in youth, I believe, ages 13 to 29. What is causing that? Why are young people at such high risk of HIV transmission? And I think policies like this, which carry forward unscientific understanding of what it is that makes you catch HIV, which carries forward these discriminatory notions of what it means to be gay in the United States, like what I experienced way back when I was 17, is part of the problem.
You describe yourself as low risk.
Correct. My husband and I have been together for 11 years, married for 7. We have a monogamous relationship. Yet under the current policy, we're banned for life. But someone who identifies as heterosexual and says in responding to the donor history questionnaire that they've had sex with someone who's HIV positive is deferred for 12 months.
Jason Cianciato is director of public policy at Gay Men's Health Crisis, an HIV AIDS service organization based right here in New York City. Thank you, Jason.
Thank you.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Lumosity, introducing a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
If you managed to catch the teaser trailer for the new Star Wars movie, Star Wars: The Force Awakens, you know that the Star Wars future world of the 1970s is going to be back soon, and it's been retro-revised.
The dark side. And the light.
Hear that? No more clones, just upgrades, say the fans. Once upon a time, Star Wars and George Lucas were the heroic rebellion challenging the Disney Empire. Then Pixar joined the rebellion. And now, well, you know, Star Wars, the new one, released a year from now, is a Disney film directed by this Star Trek dude, J.J. Abrams. Heresy, Disney, Death Star, Dominion, or hello again, Millennium Falcon. Welcome back. Kwame Opam is news editor at TheVerge.com. What's your theory?
I'm actually really excited about this.
Yeah, I think it's going to be great.
I think it's going to be great. I was actually at the theater Friday morning because Disney did this whole promotional thing where they took a handful of theaters in New York and across the country, and it was an incredible trailer. And I was actually really impressed with what J.J. is doing.
I love the little R2-D2 on the ball thing. That was so great. I really like that.
That was one of my favorite parts. My favorite part, obviously, was probably the lightsaber.
Yeah, so lightsaber was good.
Yeah.
And you know, they kept the Stormtrooper uniforms, too.
slightly upgraded.
It's slightly upgraded, but again, they're staying with the old. They're not changing the right stuff.
Right.
You know.
I have to give a lot of credit to J.J. Abrams for really capturing what was great about the original trilogy. I mean, a lot was wrong with the new trilogy, like, last decade, but
aside from the fact that it was unwatchable, Sith, Revenge of the Sith.
I mean, I was a kid when they came out, and I remember thinking, this is a lot of fun. And then I went back to watch Phantom Menace and was like, this is a, like, just irretrievably bad movie.
Yeah.
So I'm really excited about what's coming up.
You know, the interesting thing is having J.J. Abrams direct this. He really reintroduced and refreshed, in a traditional retro kind of way, the Star Trek franchise. Mm-hmm. And of course, people who the next generation or our fans of the next generation right. are going to hate what I'm saying right now. But he really turned that back around with the original characters, the original mm-hmm. style, the sort of Western in space style.
Right.
There's some of that going on here. Is he the man for the job here? Because if there's no story, it's still going to stink.
Definitely. I mean, I do sometimes worry because a lot of Star Trek fans, and I'm watching TNG as we speak, I really enjoyed the first Star Trek that Abrams did. And the second one had problems because it tried too hard to be Wrath of Khan. So I'm watching this and I'm cautiously optimistic. There's a lot going on in it that looks really great. The practical effects and just the art style that's really going back to like the 70s. But I do kind of worry that he's kind of going to go really all out, full bore with the fan service after a while? Because he kind of did that with Star Trek Into Darkness.
You know, it scares me that I understand everything that you're saying. It looked too much like Wrath of Khan. I know what that means.
Right.
That was an episode, that TV episode of Star Trek
Space
that was reprised as a movie and then re-reprised by Abrams in the second new one. Oh, that's interesting. There isn't an equivalent of that, though, in the Star Wars. They're going to have to come up with a fundamentally new story, and this seems to be Where Did the Force Come From, which is almost Lord of the Rings, Game of Thronesy.
Kind of, yeah. I mean, not that Disney has jettisoned the expanded universe, but they're pretty much working with a clean slate, and like they're free to draw from whatever inspirations they want. But yeah, this is pretty much a new story with Luke Skywalker and Leia and Han coming back. This is new territory, and it's going to be up to the fans to really be down with what Abrams is doing.
Kwame Opham is news editor at TheVerge.com, watching the developments a year from now when the new Star Wars movie comes out. Thanks so much, Kwame.
Anytime.
Have you heard the one about the cow that ate grass from underneath a power line, or the kids whose playground was next to some high-voltage towers?
A new high-voltage line over Minnesota farmland has people so angry, they've even written a song.
This line is dangerous to us, to our families, and to our farm animals.
Voices from the Midwest in the 1970s talking about the perceived health risks from the electromagnetic fields generated by the power lines that crisscrossed America, and crisscross America today. After an initial study delivered some disturbing results in 1987, the hunt was on to find out if
America's love affair with electricity may have already produced an unintended tragedy of enormous proportions.
News reporters talking about the risk of high voltage lines. Here to explain why the crisis developed and whether it still persists today is Eric German, producer at Retro Report. Thanks so much for being with us, Eric.
Thanks for having us.
You know, this is a perfect Retro Report. I remember doing this story. I remember the concerns. I referenced this 1987 study. What was that all about?
That was a study conducted by an epidemiologist named David Savitz, who looked at children with cancer in the Denver area, and he found a correlation between their exposure to the fields emitted by power lines and the incidence of leukemia.
When you have a report like that, the scientific community goes to work immediately to try to confirm those results. And that story was not as well told as the original story. Here's David Savitz.
Over time, as the body of research grew, the importance of our study overall diminished. The line of logic was that these fields are very common and that the logical prediction would be that this would be a major public health problem. And that was simply wrong.
The wrong didn't get translated necessarily to the public. How did that play out?
Well, like you said, the scientific community goes soberly to work and the media goes off to the races. And so this, when it first broke, was a story about something that's everywhere in our modern world. The world runs on electronics, and the thought that it could be secretly killing us was just an irresistibly terrifying story.
Now, is it absolutely the case that there's no possibility that in the future, you know, there won't be some problem of living around power lines, or some tipping point won't emerge? I mean, how do we feel about this now?
So there are two separate questions here. In the 1980s and 90s, we were told by the media that this would constitute a major public health threat. This would be the next smoking. And the science came back on that question, and the answer is overwhelmingly no. It's not a major public health threat. It's not like smoking. It's not going to cause big epidemics of cancer. There are some narrower questions out at the edges of detectability about whether or not these lines have any effect at all. And those questions remain unsettled. A lot of scientists, David Savitz included, the guy who did the original epidemiology, have come to believe there probably is not any kind of a threat at all. And the kind of numbers we're talking about, just so you understand, the only place that power lines have been shown to be correlated with cancer in a consistent way is with childhood leukemia, which begins as a very, very rare disease. If you filled up Madison Square Garden with children, one child in that entire stadium would contract leukemia per year. That's the baseline rate of leukemia in the United States. If the epidemiology is picking up anything at all about the effects of powerline EMFs, you'd be talking about one more kid in that stadium. And we have to understand also that nothing has been proven in terms of how these fields would be causing this to occur at all. And so the epidemiology on this is actually quite weak.
So are you off next to discover the brain tumors from cell phone use?
I didn't look into cell phones, but it's a similar question. What you're talking about is the electromagnetic spectrum. And one of the things that freaks people out is the word radiation is used to describe this kind of energy. The problem is when we hear the word radiation, we think of what comes out of nuclear reactors, right? But this is vastly less powerful, and it's a difference in kind rather than in degree. It's like saying there is such a thing as a projectile, but there's a very big difference between what comes out of a 357 Magnum and what comes out of a pea shooter. And the stuff that we're talking about here, powerline EMFs, are on the bottom end of the spectrum. They're less powerful than the waves coming out of AM radio by about 500 times.
Eric German is a producer for Retro Report. Eric, thanks so much.
Sure.
Finally, just like OPEC trillionaires have to worry about all the little people who buy their oil and gas and are the reason the energy economy exists after all, billionaires have to worry about the little people as well. As the rich get richer, they also get more dependent on the not-so-rich for markets, investments, precious stability. Seattle billionaire Nick Hanauer has been very smart and lucky in his choice of investments in the tech economy. And what he worries most about is how the lopsided scoreboard in the world economy may be ruining the whole game. Income inequality, he says, how it concentrates wealth at the top. How many Ferraris and Teslas can you buy, right? And depletes the disposable income of those at the other end. Nothing good here, Nick says. The buying power of the middle class goes down along with demand. That's recession. Their pain goes up, and that's political instability. I spoke with Nick Hanauer when I was in Seattle at KUOW last month, and he even suggested that the growth of rogue groups like ISIS may be evidence of an old phenomenon, when the poor and the working class bring out the pitchforks to take down the rich. Karl Marx talked about it back in the 19th century. John Maynard Keynes talked about it in the 20th. 21st century Hanauer says only capitalism is going to get us out of this mess.
I reject both Marx and Keynes. They're both completely wrong, in my opinion, because they both conceptualize the economy in a 19th century way, this closed linear system where if one thing goes up, another thing goes down. The reason that capitalism is the unmatched social technology in the history of the world for creating prosperity is that it's an evolutionary system for finding solutions to new human problems. That prosperity in human society really is the sum of the solutions that we find to make people's lives better. And the genius of capitalism is it rewards people for solving other people's problems. Keynes is not the answer, nor is Marx. We have to go beyond those 19th century thinkers to a way of thinking about it that's 21st century. And so I just come back to this idea of inclusion. We don't include people to give them a lottery ticket. We include them because the more innovators you have in your society, the more people you enfranchise as people who can innovate, the faster the rate of innovation goes. And the more people we enfranchise as robust consumers by, for instance, raising the minimum wage, having fair labor standards, et cetera, the more robust the demand is for that innovation. And prosperity in our technological capitalist society is a consequence of the feedback loop.
What is the point of change then? What is it that you wonder about when you look at income inequality and say to yourself, why aren't some of these people more angry?
Well, I mean, you know, like most people aren't economists, and what people have been told for a generation is that rising inequality is a sign of prosperity. It's how we know things are getting better, right? So if you accept the idea that somebody like me, a capitalist like me, rich people are job creators, then you also have to believe that the richer I get, the more jobs I create and the better it will be for you. And it is simply not true. It's a lie. The truth is that prosperity in capitalist economies does not trickle down from the top. It is built from the middle out. That A thriving middle class isn't the consequence of prosperity and growth. It's not an effect. A thriving middle class is the cause of prosperity and growth. And once you see it that way, then all of the policies that we have in place instantly are revealed to be either upside down or backwards, right? I mean, basically, the message is tax cuts for people like Nick Hanauer create growth, and investments in the middle class balloon our debt and will bankrupt our great country. And this is the oldest argument that rich people have told poor people, you know, in history, mm-hmm. right? For as long as humans have had civilizations, rich people have told poor people that our respective positions are righteous and just. I matter, you don't. Right. That is what trickle down economics is a way of instantiating this idea mm-hmm. that a few of us mm-hmm. matter mm-hmm. and the rest of you don't.
Okay.
And in a democracy, you have to get people to believe that. Otherwise, they will take, you know, they'll take your stuff away.
So two things before we go.
Yeah.
One, the growth of wealth was rapid and the result of technological yep. changes that created yep. A velocity that is extraordinary.
And is accelerating.
Yep. If there is a turnaround and a political backlash, a pendulum swinging, will it swing in the other direction at a similarly unprecedented velocity?
Well, if past is prologue, the answer to that is yes. And that's what I'm trying to avoid, right? Like at some point, most people get so angry that they, you know, react strongly and violently and often not constructively. And, you know, like what would be ideal is to moderate the amount of economic inequality our economy is creating and thus head off some sort of very unfortunate circumstance where people get so pissed that they start burning stuff down.
But America went through America almost destroyed itself two or three times trying to address this problem. In the beginning, taxing, you know, whiskey distillers right after the revolution to try to get income inequality and to make the government more secure and prosperous. That produced a revolution right after the 1776 Revolutionary War. And the U.S. Civil War, which some could argue, was a way of addressing inequality.
Sure.
Almost was actually the thing that brought about the pitchforks.
Yeah. No, absolutely. Absolutely. And we, you know, look, the thing about slavery is that it is a full employment economic strategy, right? I
mean, yeah.
If you want full employment, slavery works quite well. And a $2.13 tipped federal tipped minimum is about as close to slavery as a society can get. And I would argue that it's just stupid and self-defeating.
Well, it's explosive. It's explosive.
Yeah,
and that's
just
your argument about the contemporary
stupid.
Times.
Yeah.
All right.
And,
so before we go,
yeah.
If at some point in the future someone like me or someone not like me who is much worse off gets angry enough to pick up a pitchfork and finds themselves in a dark corner with you,
mm-hmm.
With the pitchfork like aimed straight at your neck, is your reaction to them going to be, well, finally you found me? Or will it be, something has failed? Is it me that's failed? Is it you that's failed? Who's failed if that moment happens?
Not me. No one in our society has a bigger stake in its future than the people like me who have benefited asymmetrically from it. I find it unconscionable that more people of wealth and means are not out in front of this issue. You know, nobody has a stake in the American middle class like a capitalist like me. You know, rising inequality isn't just making poor people poorer and rich people richer. It's destroying the size of the market that rich people's businesses address. It's just mind-bogglingly short-sighted. We own this problem, and only people who have benefited in this way are probably going to be able to fix it, in my opinion.
Nick Hanauer is a venture capitalist and a Washington State-based entrepreneur. We'll be continuing our conversation about income inequality throughout the week. Tomorrow we'll look at how the pitchforks are already coming out on film with Rafer Guzman, our Movie Date co-host. And we're asking you about income inequality. We're living in a new gilded age with a widening gap between the wealthiest and the rest of us all over the world. How do we fix this? Should we fix this? What steps, if any, should we take? Give us your view at 877-8-MY-TAKE. Send us a tweet at The Takeaway if you want to catch up on that conversation or listen back to anything on the program. As always, you can check us out at thetakeaway.org. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.